Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a recent Supreme Court decision has many worried about the strength of climate and conservation laws. And we take a critical look at dire predictions of Phoenix's future as temperatures are expected to get even hotter. But first, Arizona's primary election is almost here, and that means party infighting is the name of the game. And today, our politics desk is here to tell us about one political brawl that's gotten particularly ugly. Steve Slayton is a GOP candidate running in a crowded primary in Legislative District 7, which covers large swaths of Coconino, Gila, Navajo, and Pinal counties. He owns a Donald Trump-themed retail store in Sholo and is a veteran. But Slayton has been accused of inflating his military record and using racial slurs in this race, losing the support of at least one county GOP committee. But he has one steadfast and powerful supporter who's gone out of her way to back him up, Republican State Senator Wendy Rogers. She's also running for re-election in LD7, and KJZZ's Wayne Schutzke has been reporting every twist and turn here. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
Okay, so we heard about Steve Slayton, who he is, and this idea there are accusations of stolen valor out there, which folks might have heard about by now. But tell us, why is Wendy Rogers so supportive of him?
They've been running kind of as a slate, as it were. He's running in the Arizona House of Representatives race. She's running in the Arizona Senate race, so they're not competing for anything. Mm-hmm. And they have kind of been tied at the hip. She's endorsed him. You know, they have very similar political views. He obviously owns the trumped-up store in Sholo. Big supporter of former President Donald Trump, as is Wendy Rogers.
Mm-hmm. Tell us more about these accusations of racism. Who made them?
That accusation was made by Ari Bradshaw, who's another Republican who's running in a North Phoenix legislative district for the Arizona House of Representatives. He has basically said he heard Slayton use the N-word, essentially, to describe his opponents in the Republican primary up in LD7, including Representative David Marshall, who is black, who is an incumbent representative running for re-election to his seat. He confronted Rogers about that in a recorded phone call that has since been posted online, and Rogers very much downplayed it and kind of warned Bradshaw not to mess with this, to stay out of it. She says you're playing with fire and that I can't help you anymore is, I think, the term she used, kind of warning him to stay quiet about this, to which Bradshaw kind of responded like, these aren't like rumors. I heard this with my own ears.
Huh. So she came to Slayton's defense there. What about the accusations of stolen valor? What's behind those?
Yeah, so I want to clarify. No one's saying Slayton didn't serve in the military. He is an Army veteran. They're saying he embellished his record. So he has claimed that he has a Vietnam combat veteran, whereas some stolen valor groups that investigate these claims that people are embellishing their record or never served, say they got copies of his records from the federal government, from the archives, from the institutions that hold these records, and they do not show that they show that he served in Korea, I believe, as a helicopter mechanic, but did not see combat in Vietnam. So Slayton shows a different version of the same document that appears to show other medals and awards and those type of things to the contrary. And so there's just an argument here over which document is valid, essentially.
Mm. So is any of this affecting Wendy Rogers and her race for re-election? Like, who is she up against?
Yeah, she's running against David Cook, who is a representative from the district who's termed out of the Arizona House of Representatives. He comes from Globe, which is nowhere near Flagstaff, where she serves out of. But like you said, it's a really big district.
Yeah.
And she has a huge fundraising advantage. She is the most prolific fundraiser in the legislature, raises millions of dollars each campaign, which is unheard of for those type of races.
Right.
So huge fundraising advantage over him. But now we're starting to see money come in against her from outside groups that could actually help Cook and offset that fundraising advantage a bit.
Tell us about those groups.
So the group that's doing it, it's hard to trace back the money, but you have to jump through a couple different political action committees. But it looks like it's coming from a labor union, so a left-leaning group here in Arizona. But it's being funneled through a Republican firm, essentially the people they're paying to buy these ads and these type of things, that is tied to Congressman Andy Biggs and Paul Gosar, who were thought to be allies of Rogers.
Hmm. But it still appears as if Rogers has the support of the state Republican Party.
Yes. So up on a radio station in rural Arizona that covers some of these districts, a staffer from GOP got on the radio and kind of brought these accusations to light. And he's an Army veteran himself. And Rogers actually called in to defend Slayton's, you know, says she buys his version of events. And this guy kind of told her, you're putting your reputation on the line by doing this. And he said the next day he got his walking papers from the state party.
Oh, so tell us about the reaction to this from Rogers herself. Has she responded to any of this criticism, these accusations?
She hasn't responded to me directly, but Mountain Daily News, which was a rural outlet that has covered a lot of this from the beginning, has been kind of following her and following all her comments on this. And yet she essentially is saying she believes Slayton. Slayton has claimed that he's the victim of identity theft and these documents are fraudulent and what have you, even though they've come directly from the federal government, the ones that seem to call his story into question. And she says she buys that. She says he's a veteran. She stands by him. She has gone after other veteran groups that have come out against him. And as far as the accusations of using racist language, again, I think that call with Bradshaw says everything. She doesn't seem to concern her all that much that he used the language, allegedly, but that someone is bringing it to light.
This is, as we said, a crowded Republican primary that Steve Slayton is in. Do we know how this might be affecting his race?
That part's really difficult to say because, again, we don't get a lot of polling or things like that in legislative races. I will say that, you know, as you said, the Navajo County GOP, so one of the Republican groups that represents a part of this district, has come out and asked for him to drop out of the race. And there have been several veterans groups and just individual veterans who have picketed and called for the same because they believe the allegations that he is embellishing his record. So you could see in a race where, you know, I believe there's five people going for two seats that this is not helping him.
Yeah. What about when it comes to Wendy Rogers' race? As you said, she is this incredibly prolific fundraiser at the legislative level. Even with this money coming in against her, do you think that this will be a tight race?
I think it will be. I think even prior to all of this, I think there's a segment of the Republican Party, you know, kind of the non-MAGA segment, who is more in Representative David Cook's camp. He's not exactly an unknown figure down at the Capitol. You know, he's sponsored some prominent legislation, most notably the Taylor Swift bills I've talked about before to go after ticket scalpers. So he has a bit of a known entity. He's a rancher. You know, he identifies with rural Arizona. The biggest knock on him was that Rogers is just such a prominent figure in the Republican Party and has all this money that he would kind of get drowned out. So, again, going back to the money, these independent expenditures against Rogers could potentially help him, you know, get some of that negative ads out there against her without actually having to dig into his own campaign to do it.
All right. One to watch for sure. KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky with our politics desk. Wayne, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Late last month, the Supreme Court voted to overrule Chevron v. National Resources Defense Council. The landmark 1984 decision gave rise to the Chevron Doctrine, which has now been struck down in a 6-3 decision along ideological lines by the 9 Supreme Court justices. The precedent set in that case has meant that for decades, courts have deferred to federal agencies when interpreting vague laws. It's been one of the most cited administrative law cases ever, and now it's gone. And that has wide-reaching consequences. And with me now to talk about the impact of environmental issues here is Aaron X. Wong from High Country News. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning.
So tell us first, what did the Chevron Doctrine do, and what does it mean that it's been struck down here?
Sure. So as you said, you know, it was a precedent of administrative law. It was established in 1984, and under Chevron, judges would defer to federal agencies wherever the law was ambiguous. And so without Chevron, agencies don't have the same leeway that they used to have to interpret the law. And, you know, over the course of the last 40 years, you know, Congress has been drafting laws and agencies have been enforcing them under this expectation that they would have more leeway. And and without it, it means that there's a radical shift in power from the executive branch to the judicial branch.
To the judicial. Okay. So let's talk about what you looked at here. You looked at public lands, wildlife conservation, environmental impacts on those kinds of laws. Let's start with public lands. What could this mean in that arena?
Sure. So I think in general, it's really difficult to say at this stage, you know, which area will be most impacted. It really depends on what's battled out in court. But I think legal experts are concerned that it will be, you know, they're concerned specifically about ambiguities in law. Like one, for instance, governing public lands, there's multiple use mandates that, you know, govern how the Forest Service or how the Bureau of Land Management prioritizes, you know, how people are using the land. And the Biden administration, for instance, you know, recently issued a rule that elevated conservation to the same level of importance as energy extraction.
Right.
And not everyone agrees with that. So that has already been challenged. And that, for instance, could be overruled.
Hmm. What does it mean when it comes to wildlife conservation efforts? There's been big shifts in this under the Biden administration as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one caveat I'll say is that it's really difficult to say that you know, the striking down Chevron immediately means that, you know, it's bad for species. We spoke to one expert who said that, you know, the Endangered Species Act is relatively prescriptive. So it means that it could be harder to delist species under it without Chevron. But I do think that in general, it's pretty concerning you know, we're no longer relying on the expertise of agencies. So specifically with wildlife, you know, there's experts in habitat restoration, for instance, and instead of them, you'll have judges making the final call.
Okay. What about when it comes to the most vulnerable issue here in terms of the environment? What do you think is probably most at risk with this big change?
Sure. I think that climate change is probably the most important issue that's going to be challenged because many of these fundamental laws like the Clean Air Act, you know, were drafted a long time ago and climate change is a relatively new issue. And so we've seen the EPA, particularly under the Biden administration, issue rules that limit greenhouse gas emissions from power plants that encourage a shift away from or a shift towards electric vehicles. And I think all of those might be challenged without Chevron.
It sounds like all of this could be a big blow to President Biden's environmental legacy. Like he's made some major efforts to combat climate change, and a lot of those could be called into question now.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's the key fear is that, is that there's sweeping rules issued and many argue that like they are overstepping what statutes have said.
Yeah. Let me ask you about energy as well, a big issue right now. Is there any effect here in terms of like transmission lines, clean energy? You looked at those issues as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. So I think one piece that's interesting is that the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, a lot of those rules are issued by the Treasury Department and a lot of them get really, you know, nitty gritty. And so that's one area where we could see some challenges. I would say also for transmission lines that we've already seen legal challenges in where, you know, how grid operators are planning ahead and how they're going to be able to add solar panels, wind, you know, it's getting to be very complicated for how they do their work. And it's important for FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, to be able to be very careful in how it governs grid operators.
Yeah. Let me ask you in the last minute or so here, I know High Country News also rounded up some other major issues that are affected by this ruling or could be tribal law, labor, things like that. What were some of the other major issues at hand?
Sure. Yeah. So it's really going to touch on every aspect, every single agency. And that could include emerging technology. I think a lot of people are worried about how to, regulate artificial intelligence. I would say, especially for tribal law, we are going to see, a little less reliance on agency expertise and those who are working closest to communities.
Mm-hmm. All right. We will leave it there for now. That is Aaron X. Wong with High Country News joining us to talk more about the impact of this recent Supreme Court decision, getting rid of the Chevron doctrine, as it's known. Aaron, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, an inside look at how universities like the U of A partner with for-profit companies to run their online schools.
On top of just the financial cost, one of the other areas that students complain about is what their employability will be after they complete the program and how it is so easy to mislead students about the value of a degree and the employability of graduates.
A journalist details the shady practices that can leave students feeling cheated. But first, it is Phoenix in the summer, and it's hot. That is no surprise in the Valley of the Sun. But things are changing. It's getting hotter and drier. More people are dying every year from the heat. We are running out of water. We can't build anymore. The urban heat island is stopping nights from cooling down like they used to. Planes can't even take off. Those are probably all headlines you have read in recent Phoenix summers. We might as well all leave now. But we're not. In fact, Phoenix is still growing and fast. But how much longer can that continue with all of this doom and gloom predicted in a climate-changed future? Will we end up a 130-degree deserted wasteland, a massive city dried up in the desert sun? Well, our next guests say no. But it's complicated. To find out more, I sat down with Dr. Matei Georgescu, director of ASU's Urban Climate Research Center, as well as longtime Arizona journalist Ray Stern, who's debunked predictions of Phoenix's apocalyptic future for years. And I started with the big question, are we doomed?
Absolutely not. I mean, people can be asking that same question, and we're asking, for example, why is New Orleans expanding the way it is? Or why is Miami expanding and growing the way it is? And probably argue that those cities are in much greater danger in the near term than Phoenix is currently or will be for the foreseeable future.
What about, like, scientifically? Like, is the heat not as big of a concern, or are the concerns exaggerated about the, you know, the problems that the heat will cause in the future?
It depends who you ask. The numbers are the numbers, and it's easier to look at the observations. So if you go back 30, 40 years ago, Phoenix would experience, let's say, 10 to 20 days of 110-plus Fahrenheit days during a summer. On average, there are some summers that are less, some that are more. You look at last year, it was, I think, 55 days of 110 plus, and I believe every day in July, that's 31 consecutive days of 110 plus, that really screams at you that something is happening. Of course, these are two endpoints in time, so you want to try to connect these endpoints and get a feel for what the trend is, and the trend is clear. We are warming. Mm-hmm. There is no denying that. The question is, what are we doing about it as a human species, as a Phoenicians? Mm-hmm. Are we adaptable? Are we ingenious? Can we adapt to this climate and can we thrive into the future? I think that's the more appropriate question. And in my opinion, the answer is unequivocally, absolutely, yes. We can adapt and we will adapt.
I love that optimism. Ray, let me turn to you. You wrote a long piece about this exact issue and these exact kind of accusations about the future of Phoenix and the Valley in general for the Phoenix New Times, you know, almost a decade ago now. You're sort of debunking a lot of the myths surrounding the future of Phoenix from what you see. It's called Apocalypse No, I should say. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what's interesting here to me is not that you were able to kind of disprove some of these big claims about how Phoenix will, you know, never be around in the future, but that this is a narrative that's been around for so long.
It really has. This long preceded the story that I did 10 years ago. But the story that I did was kind of a pushback against a sort of flurry of this myth-making that was coming out just after the recession. As you recall, Phoenix was very heavily hit by the recession. We lost 50% of our property values. People were moving out. People were very worried about the future of Phoenix. Mm-hmm. And the climate change and the sort of anti-Phoenix crowd took the ball and ran with it. And we started seeing a lot more stories right around the beginning of the 2010s about how Phoenix had no future. There was a book, for example, it was called Bird on Fire, and it said lessons from the least sustainable city in the world. It's absolutely a ludicrous assertion, honestly. But a lot of people read that book. And so this myth that Phoenix is doomed and would either get too hot or we'd be completely out of water is actually believed by a lot of people now.
Yeah. And there's also a narrative in that, not just that we're doomed, but also that we're irresponsible for being here, right? Like that this city should not exist in the desert, at least not at this size, this scale. Yet, I mean, it's still been the fastest growing metropolitan area in the country for a lot of those years since you wrote that piece.
It has. And that's actually one of the things that bugs me the most, because people are, you know, if they're not from here, they may be ignorant of the history of this place. But really, everyone in the United States should understand that here in the Phoenix area was one of the most technological, advanced indigenous communities in North America. It was a civilization, the Hohokam, and they were here for 1,000 years. So you can't tell me that this place isn't built for city. The reason that they were here for so long, by the way, is because there's lots of water here.
Hmm. We'll talk about water more in a minute. But it's interesting you bring up the Hohokam, because there's also sort of a myth around them now that the reason they abandoned this valley after living here for 1,000 years is part of why people think it will be abandoned again in our future.
Totally. But really, there's actually no proof of that. And there is proof that the Hohokam had endured massive droughts over their 1,000-year history here. And when they apparently vacated the area, and they didn't vanish, obviously, they moved, and mm-hmm. some of them still lived here. But their civilization became much poorer for mm-hmm. whatever reason. But it wasn't in the middle of a massive drought.
Yeah. So a long narrative in many senses here. Matt, let me turn to you. I mean, you mentioned that, yes, like it is true and scientifically verifiable that we are warming, that it is getting hotter, and that there are real concerns around that. What are the concerns from your point of view?
Well, one of the major concerns has to do with what we experienced last summer. So last summer was unique in many ways. Mm-hmm. We experienced, like we said a few moments ago, 55 some odd days of 110 plus. In the second half of the current century, that's going to become a mainstream summer. It will no longer be an extreme situation. So mm-hmm. that takes a little bit of getting used to, not in terms of a biophysical adaptation perspective, but you think about water resources, you think about energy infrastructure. These are all important elements of ensuring that the livelihoods of Phoenicians and other desert areas across the U.S. and the globe can not only subsist but thrive.
Do we know how much, Matt, the climate here will be hotter in the future? There have been claims that it'll be 130 degrees, right?
Yes, there have been such claims. It's important to note that the hottest temperature ever recorded in Phoenix, and this goes back well over 100 years, was 122 degrees Fahrenheit back in 1990. I believe it was June of 1990. We mm-hmm. haven't touched that value since. A couple of things to keep in mind. The longer that your record extends, the greater the likelihood that you're going to break some record.
That's interesting,
right?
Yeah.
it is very likely at some point within the near future, far future, it's hard to say exactly when, that we're going to hit 122 and 123 at some point. Mm-hmm. That's going to happen. It's almost inevitable only by virtue of extending this record. Now, when you add climate change on top of that, then the likelihood increases. The prospects of hitting mid-130s, as was mentioned in some of the previous work that has been documented by Ray, is highly unlikely. Mm. Highly unlikely. It's just basic physics. Unless we have a runaway planet in which nobody will be living on this planet, we're unlikely to see temperatures in the mid-130s by mid-century. That's just not going to happen. What we're very likely to see, however, and probably as soon as this decade, is a minimum temperature that doesn't go below the triple digits.
Right.
And so that's going to make the situation completely different from what long-term Phoenicians have been used to. And that will be something that we're going to have to deal with, again, probably through mid-century and beyond.
Yeah. What about the tally of heat deaths, heat-related deaths? Like, this is something that has been shooting up, right, in terms of the numbers from the Maricopa County Medical Examiner's Office. Is this going to continue to be a problem? Like, can people live in this kind of heat safely?
So the answer is yes. People like us that spent most of their time indoors, roughly 90%, are going to have an easier time of mm-hmm. adapting. And I think the question is for those that don't have the financial resources, that are underhoused, and then it becomes an issue of, yes, you might be able to make it a night or two, but imagine the July situation that we were faced with last year, which mm-hmm. will become a thing of the norm, that will become very commonplace. Then it becomes really debilitating, really yeah. very difficult to deal with. So there's a policy issue, there's a governance issue, and from the general population, the notion is, well, it's not my problem, the city will figure it out. There's right. also a values issue to consider here. What can we collectively do to make sure that we don't have to deal with these situations, or at least mitigate them mm-hmm. to some extent.
Right. And last year, a record number of 110 degree days in a row apparently contributed to the extra high number of heat deaths that we had last year. It was quite a jump from the year before, 52% more. It's also important, I think, that people realize that about half of the heat death problem in Maricopa County is, in fact, a meth problem. 47% of the heat deaths in Maricopa County last year were actually drug deaths that were heat associated. So heat was a contributing factor, and 80% or so. So basically most of the drug-related deaths were meth-related. So if you took meth out of this situation, that would really reduce our heat deaths by about half. And just as a side note, meth is a drug that actually can cause heat stroke for anybody at room temperature.
Hmm.
Your comment, which has been substantiated numerously across the media and journal articles, really highlights the socioeconomic element of this issue. It's not merely a heat and temperature issue. There are other elements to consider here.
Yeah.
But also, we just have to remember that that is about 2% of our society, and it's a difficult situation, and I'm not going to, you know, downplay it.
Yeah.
But the fact is that 98% of us live with either air conditioning or swamp coolers, and that will continue into the future. This is a futuristic city. I guess you could say that maybe there shouldn't be a city here, or there wouldn't be a city here, rather, if there was no such thing as air conditioning. Air conditioning is essential, and also electricity to keep those air conditionings running is essential.
And we'll talk more about that when we come back. That is longtime Arizona journalist Ray Stern, along with Dr. Matei Georgescu, director of ASU's Urban Climate Research Center, joining me to talk about Phoenix and the heat and what it means for our collective future. We'll be back with more after the break. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger, and we're back with more of our deep dive conversation about the Valley's extreme heat and what it means for our region's future. I'm joined by the director of ASU's Urban Climate Research Center, Dr. Matei Georgescu, and the Arizona Republic's Ray Stern, a longtime journalist in the state who's written a lot about the heat here. So I want to talk about electricity in a moment, but let's take a minute first to talk about water, because that's the other big thing that comes up when we think about Phoenix's futures. Can you sustain this massive and growing city in the desert as we are, as everyone keeps saying, running out of water? We know the Colorado River is shrinking. This is true. Lake Powell, our big reservoirs, are shrinking. But is this your biggest concern, Matt?
So long as we continue to manage the local water sources as effectively as we have been, I think it's not a major concern.
Mm-hmm.
So in the Southeastern Valley, SRP is your local water utility, and they manage wonderful watersheds in the northern highlands of Arizona. Their concern is more with how do we retain all of the water that floods out of the reservoirs when we have an extreme winter like we did 2 years ago or even last year.
Yeah,
that's a lot of water that was lost.
Talk about counterintuitive there.
So much water running over the Tempe Town Lake.
Exactly.
Watching that, and there was no way to capture all of that.
Huh.
That's right. Now, if you live in the Northwest Valley, then you've got different concerns because your main source of water is the CAP. It's the Colorado River. And with the Colorado River, what our research has shown, we've looked at, so we do both future projections, but we also look at the observations. We've actually shown that regardless of how you define Southwest, is it just Arizona or is it just Arizona, New Mexico, or is it California and Arizona? Regardless of what your definition is, precipitation hasn't changed historically over the last 70 years.
Wait, so you're saying this narrative that we are getting drier in the sense that there's less rain is not true?
Our results say that is not true.
Wow.
That's correct. The question is, where's the water going? Mm-hmm. We agree that the world is warming. Mm-hmm. So with a warming world, then you're going to have more evaporation. And so that's one source of the water loss. But by far the biggest contributor is, if we think of it in terms of a banking analogy, if you make $1 per day but take out $2 per day, then you're going to be in the negative pretty soon. And so that's what's actually happening.
Mm-hmm. Right. Ray, I want to ask you a little bit about the history here, right? Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that I always think is very interesting in talking about water in Arizona is that we're actually pretty well off. And it's because we've always known that we're in a desert, right? Like we've planned for this for a long time.
Absolutely. We are a leader in water conservation. A lot of people don't realize that the whole state uses less water now than it did 60 years ago.
Which is wild, yeah.
It's wild. That's both for agriculture and residents. And, of course, the residential population has absolutely exploded over the last 60 years. So now we have 7 million people here using less water than a few hundred thousand 60 years ago. This needs to continue. One of the biggest factors for saving all of that water is the 1980 Groundwater Management Act. And it's not completely sufficient to go into the future. So there needs to be some tweaking in the laws and maybe some major pounding on some people that are really overusing water. And that probably needs to be curtailed to some extent. And I think it will. Everyone sees the problem as something that needs to be adjusted. So I think that, yes, we don't know what the worst possible case scenario could be. Mm-hmm. But from what we know now, there will be enough water for the future. And I guess I just wanted to point out, too, that some people may believe that the Colorado River and the CAP Canal will just completely stop flowing at some point. And that would be a kind of a disaster for this area. 50% or so rely on that water. But does the data show that that is likely? And the answer is no. Hmm. People talk about the fact that Lake Mead and Lake Powell could go below Deadpool, which is the term for what happens when you can no longer generate hydropower electricity. But it doesn't mean that water won't still flow over the CAP, through the CAP canal. It'll be less, and we'll have to deal with less. But I think that history has shown that we can deal with less.
Let me ask you, Matt, about a study that you did last year that did sound relatively doom and gloom about the future of the city, which was about our electricity use and capacity. You basically found that if we had a blackout during a heat wave, the results could be really catastrophic. Describe that a little bit for us and the implications there.
We asked a really simple question, and Ray, you mentioned a few minutes ago the low likelihood of Deadpool. Well, actually, it's important to kind of look at those sort of questions and ask, what are the possible consequences of this were it to happen? Because it's this sort of instant that raises immediate alarm bells about what we can do now to prepare for this low likelihood event. This low likelihood event was a 4-day heat wave, the sort of heat wave that we experience here on an annual summertime basis, coincident with no electricity. So no electricity anymore available for anyone. And what our results indicate is that, first of all, if that were to happen, the number of emergency beds that would be required for all of the heat-related adverse outcomes, we don't have that many in the Phoenix metropolitan area. We know that number now because of COVID.
It's a tiny fraction.
Yeah. We would need something like 80,000. We have something like 3,000 emergency hospital beds across Phoenix. The number of deaths would be in the 10 to 12,000 range. Again, low likelihood event, but it immediately raises questions about what can we do to plan for this less than 1% likelihood event if it were to happen.
And you think we should be planning for that?
I think absolutely we should be planning for this the way we plan for hurricane season, for example.
Right. This is our hurricane,
Yeah.
So that brings me to my final question for each of you here, which is sort of about, I guess, a counter narrative that is possible and that I've seen, you know, written about and talked about a little bit. And you both are kind of touching on it here, which is that there is maybe a way of looking at this differently, a way of looking at the climate change future of the Valley of the Sun as an opportunity, I guess, as a chance for improvement, maybe as a model for the rest of the world where it's also getting hotter and they may be less prepared. Should we be thinking about it more like that?
But I do think that Phoenix and Phoenicians can teach people how to deal with heat because we have to deal with it every summer. And people that get out in the heat understand different ways and methods that you can use. I'm a jogger and I love to hike the mountain preserves here all year long. But I don't do it in the middle of the day when the solar radiation is going to just kill me.
So thinking about it differently and using the day differently, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
We can cope with it. Humans actually live all over the world in very hot temperatures and they have for hundreds and thousands of years, and they've also dealt with their water problems. So we can too.
What do you think about this, Matt? Do you think there's an alternative narrative here we're missing?
Oh, absolutely. So we shouldn't be randomly, and I'm not suggesting that we are randomly going about and letting time pass and seeing where the chips fall, but we should be designing our own futures. But until we ask the question, what is the desired outcome, we're not in the position to design what our own future is. Where do we want to be in the next 50 to 100 years environmentally concerned?
Mm-hmm.
How do we want to source our energy? Do we want it to be local or do we want to source it from somewhere else? I think Phoenix is doing great, right? You've got abundant sunshine throughout the year. I think we should be exporting this throughout the entire western and perhaps even eastern United States, I guess, instead of exporting water to other portions of the world, as one example.
We need to do all those things because we have a desire to live here and people have a desire to move here. Mm-hmm. That's been the trend for decades now, and apparently it's going to continue. That's probably the number one issue to our sustainability. We have the technology, and there's a history of being a leader in water conservation and heat response. So as long as we continue to do the right things, then we can survive here even as it's getting hotter. And we can also teach the rest of the country how to deal with heat because they're going to have that problem as well.
There's a reason that guess this is data from just 2 years ago. According to the U.S. Census, the fastest growing city in the United States, city, not metropolitan area, remains Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be prepared for additional folks to come here. It's happening. So again, how do we work towards improved efficiency of energy and water distribution and thermal equity for those? Ray termed it as less than 2%. I think it's that 2% that are actually pivotal mm-hmm. in making sure that we safeguard those that cannot help themselves. Let's enable and let's empower them to help themselves. I think that that's critical. And that's a hallmark of a city that is truly sustainable.
We need to do a better job of making sure that the people that are vulnerable are taken care of. It's a terrible way to die, obviously, and we don't want to see that happen to anybody.
And it's a terrible way to live.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. That is Ray Stern, Arizona Republic reporter and longtime Arizona journalist, joined by Dr. Matei Georgescu, director of ASU's Urban Climate Research Center. Thank you both so much for coming in and talking this through with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. A recent investigation by the Arizona Republic found a number of students at the University of Arizona Global Campus say they were taken advantage of. The complaints range from being misled about the value of their degrees to the cost of their education. The U of A bought Ashford University in 2020 and rebranded it as the University of Arizona Global Campus. Prior to the deal, Ashford had been sued over allegations of using deceptive tactics to recruit students. This isn't the only school where students have alleged these kinds of things have happened. Michael Vasquez is the senior investigative reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education, and he has reported on this. He spoke with my co-host, Mark Brody, and they started with how prevalent it is that universities partner with for-profit companies to provide their online programs.
This is a growing and very murky part of American higher education. The whole online learning boom, which dates back to the George W. Bush administration, was led by for-profit colleges, many of them publicly traded on Wall Street. And they did get it down to a science to a certain extent, certain aspects of that business, whether it be the recruitment of students or creating interactive online teaching platforms. And so now, as public institutions or nonprofit traditional colleges have tried to branch out into the online space and recruit more online students, in many cases, they are partnering with these for-profit companies, with the argument being that those companies are more experienced in this area.
So are these companies exclusively in the recruitment business? Like, do they do anything else, for example, once the students sign up to take these online classes?
It can vary company by company. In many cases, these companies specialize in student recruitment. And that is probably the big lure when you have large public institutions partnering with these online for-profit companies. What in many cases attracts the traditional colleges to enter into these partnerships is they assume, perhaps correctly, perhaps incorrectly, that these for-profit companies are better at finding students and convincing them to sign up. The problem is that while these companies may have a strong record of finding and recruiting students, the methods that they have often used have been sometimes unethical, sometimes you could argue immoral, frankly, and predatory. And so if you have the University of Arizona or any other institution with a generally good reputation, you sometimes wonder, well, who exactly are they getting into business with here?
Well, so let's talk about some of the ways that these companies can recruit students. I mean, you mentioned that they are in some cases unethical or predatory. Like, what kinds of things do they do?
There are two or three main areas where things can go horribly wrong at the recruitment phase. And I've spoken over the years with many, many students who enrolled in online programs, sometimes run by for-profit, you know, operators. Sometimes these online programs are a partnership between, you know, a traditional college and a for-profit company.
Mm-hmm.
But what often happens when you talk to students who ended up for the worse, for the experienced, and you try to figure out, well, what was the problem here? There's a couple of crucial areas. Students often, if they are unhappy and they feel they were misled, they will complain about misunderstandings or outright lies that were told to them about how much is this going to cost. I've spoken to students time and time again who we're told sometimes that there won't be any loans at all. On top of just the financial cost, one of the other areas that students complain about is what their employability will be after they complete the program, and how it is so easy to mislead students about the value of a degree and the employability of graduates. And the last piece of it that I'll say in terms of the deception and how the deception could work is related to accreditation. That you have many, many career tracks, many programs where if you go to college to get an associate's, to get a bachelor's degree in a particular field, in many cases, you need a certain specific accreditation to be employable after you graduate. So a college can say to a prospective student, they can say, hey, we're accredited by the Higher Learning Commission or some other broad accreditor that really just reviews the institution overall. Mm-hmm. And so that might the student think, okay, well, this is an accredited college. I'm safe to go here. But what the student does not know is, let's say you want to be a nutritionist. Let's say you want to be a physical therapist. There are specific programmatic accreditations that you need to get as a student. You need to attend a program that is programmatically approved by these entities that specialize in physical therapy or in nutrition or just all sorts of careers. And if they don't have that, you can spend 4 or 5 years getting a degree that is arguably worthless.
For students who fall into these categories, do they have recourse either with the online companies or with the nonprofit universities that are working with them?
That to say, in many cases, the student complaints are ignored or they are filed away in some shelf somewhere. But it is really, really hard for students to get justice. There have been some students who have benefited from loan forgiveness, which can be administered by the federal government. So there's a provision within federal law that states that if a student is deceived, if there is evidence of unsavory practices, and the federal government has its kind of standards for, to prove that you were defrauded by your college. But if you can prove you were defrauded by your college, there is an avenue to get loan forgiveness. That can take many, many years. And in numerous cases, students who were ripped off don't qualify, because it's not only getting ripped off, but then you have to prove that you were ripped off.
What have these for-profit companies said about all this? And what have nonprofit colleges said about their continued relationships with them?
It's a very tricky thing, because I think sometimes the debate about this topic, when we talk about online education and we talk about for-profit education, and those two areas very much overlap, sometimes the industry, when it defends itself, it will make the argument that, how can you paint with such a broad brush? You can't say every college is going to be, predatory just because of its tax status, just because it's a for-profit institution. And that is true. But realistically, if you have a situation where out of X number of companies, a third or half or whatever the percentage might be, if there's a huge percentage of companies who are getting into legal trouble, who are paying, multi-million dollar legal settlements for predatory practices, I think the obvious issue in front of us is that there's something going on here.
Given all of this that's been coming out and student complaints and all, does it seem as though nonprofit universities are starting to rethink working with these kinds of companies?
There's a fork in the road, and if we're not there, I think we're fast approaching this moment where colleges that consider these kinds of partnerships, if you have a state institution, if you have a traditional not-for-profit kind of residential college, and they consider these partnerships, there have been enough scandals in enough places where the faculty are going to ask some tough questions. And so I don't know if these partnerships disappear, but it's going to be a lot harder going forward for colleges to do this easily, to sort of, just get this approved by their governing board without any kind of pushback, because at best, the track record of these partnerships is mixed.
All right. That is Michael Vasquez, senior investigative reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Michael, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, that'll do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. Be sure to join us tomorrow morning with much more, as always. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, Ayana Hamilton, Gabriella Fernbaugh, and reporter Sam Dingman, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor. Chad Snow is our news director. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. We are at theshow@kjzz.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.